ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
That phrase, all art is a haunting, man, I rewrote that sentence so many times.
Congratulations to Omar Musa. His hard work has paid off. He is now the winner of this year's Miles Franklin Literary Award for his novel about Borneo, palm oil, complicity, and tree ghosts. I'm Claire Nichols, and this is a bonus episode of The Book Show to celebrate Omar's award-winning novel, Fierce Land.
Hello.
Hey, Omar, congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Can you tell me how you found out, Omar?
I was called by one of the judges and I was on a research trip in the southern Philippines in Zamboanga City in the Sulu region in Mindanao. And I was walking along the street, ducking and dodging motorized tricycles. And then I got a call and I was like, what's going on here? And when I found out, I just kind of stopped in the middle of the street and then I had to kind of walk over to the side so I didn't get run over. And yeah, couldn't believe it.
Who was the first person you had to tell?
Told my mum and my wife.
Amazing.
Immediately, yeah. It was funny too because like my dad is a big believer in dreams and dream interpretation. He was like, oh yeah, I dreamed that you won it. Like he had said that months before. He was like, yeah, you've got it in the bag because I dreamed it. I was like, I don't think it works that way, but maybe it does.
Well, it must mean so much to your dad as well because, I mean, this all started with, you know, stories of your dad's homeland, right?
Yeah, totally. It was me trying to turn my gaze back towards my origins in Southeast Asia, trying to think about the forest and about land and loss in Malaysian Borneo, oil palm, logging. Yeah. It's been a pretty amazing journey because it took me 6 years to write Fierce Land and 21 drafts. And so it's a pretty amazing feeling to be recognized for that. But not just me, you know, like all the advisors and mentors and editors and people I had conversations with. I feel like all of those people have been honored by this as well.
So what do you need to know about Fierce Land? It is about two siblings, Rosanna and Harun, who are mourning the death of their dad. And this grief, it's complicated because their father, Yusuf, was a palm oil baron. Grappling with his legacy is no small feat. Fierce Land is a book that is also sprinkled with magic. The first character we meet is the forest, which speaks in poetry. And we also hear stories of Pontianics, or tree ghosts. Omar explained these to me when we first spoke about this book, Fierce Land, last year.
A Pontianak is a vampiric ghost of Malaysian and Indonesian folklore, usually a woman who died in childbirth or died at the hands of a man, and then comes back to haunt the man that wronged her and sort of appears with long black hair and a white dress and smelling of perfume. And she's pretty scary because if you hear a Pontianak's laughter close by, it means that she's far away. But if you hear it far away, it means she's close. So, pretty scary vampiric ghost. But also kind of a complicated thing in our folklore, because I would say that in some ways the myth of the Pontianak is a way of perpetuating patriarchy in Malay society through folklore, because the way that, you can subdue a Pontianak is by driving a nail into the back of her head. And then after that, she becomes a submissive, domesticated housewife again. So it's a bit of a strange one. You know, you grow up with these ghost stories, and then maybe later in life you realize that there are these kind of darker resonances, darker even than, you know, a ghost story.
And did you hear these stories growing up, Omar?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, Ghost stories are rife in Malaysian culture, and especially in Borneo, there's all sorts of ghost stories and superstitions and spirits and all sorts of stuff. And so my dad used to love telling me ghost stories when I was a kid, and scary stories about, you know, when he was walking through the graveyard and he would hear the laughter far away, or, you know, the barking of dogs that might accompany the arrival of an evil spirit, or smelling a frangipani even, you know. So when my dad moved to Australia, you know, frangipanis to an Aussie are such a beautiful, fragrant flower, but to a lot of Malays, they grow in graveyards, so they kind of have this kind of scary connotation and maybe even remind you of a Pontianak.
Wow. So your dad came across from Borneo. What about you, Omar? Have you spent a lot of time there?
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time in Borneo. I only went a few times as a kid. And then, you know, I was born and raised in Australia. Mm-hmm. But then probably when I was about 19, I went back, really reconnected with my family. And from my early 20s on, I would go at least once a year. And then a couple of years ago, I moved back to Kota Kinabalu in the state of Sabah, which is the easternmost state of Malaysian Borneo, where my dad comes from. And that was a whole other experience. You know, I've described it as being a very enriching, confronting, confusing, soul-stirring experience, but one that was necessary for me as a human, but also for this book, I'd say.
This is a book about Borneo. It's about ghosts or Pontianaks. It's also about deforestation. It's about the palm oil trade. It's about art. It's about commerce. It's about colonialism. This is a big question, Omar, but what was on your mind when this all started?
I think all of those things were on my mind, but then it also just boiled down to the dynamics of a family and of mm-hmm. siblings, and how two siblings were reckoning with the legacy of their father and of their parents. And a question that I think a lot of people ask themselves, which is, how do I mourn a person who I loved very deeply, but who was also a pretty messed up person and did messed up things. This one is a story that's kind of writ large, because if you're a palm oil baron, then you're potentially, you know, dispossessing people of land, using hugely exploitative and extractive practices, destroying priceless rainforest. So, you know, this is a much sort of larger story, and I was trying to tell the story of colonialism and exploitation in Borneo through this family dynamic. But I guess that's what was on my mind. I was also thinking about just complicity, you know, personal privilege and complicity, and how we participate as individuals in systems that are much larger than ourselves, systems of oppression and exploitation, and whether we engage with those systems through choice or coercion. So these were a couple of the things that were on my mind.
Was it also about writing a novel about Borneo itself? I mean, I don't think I've ever read fiction set here before.
Oh, most definitely. My first novel, Here Come the Dogs, was very much inspired by growing up in Queanbeyan, New South Wales. It was about race relations in Australia, what I see as quite a combustible society in certain ways. And I realized once I'd written that out of my system, I wanted to turn my attention towards the Malaysian Indonesian archipelago, towards my heritage and my history. And at first I set about writing a kind of seafaring epic that was all about the islands and borderlessness. But I realized as I kept going back to Borneo that actually I was intrigued by the forest and mm-hmm. the land and the rivers, by logging and the palm oil industry. And I realized that I had a kind of unique insight, I guess, because in my family, my dad has a lot of brothers and sisters, and I was the only nephew or cousin that grew up in the West in Australia. And most of my cousins grew up on palm oil plantations, and their parents were workers. And so from a young age going to Borneo, I got a little bit of an insight into palm oil, which is a very controversial topic in the West. You know, there's all sorts of people that will call for the ban of palm oil and palm oil products. And of course, it is a really exploitative practice and destructive practice. But in a place like Malaysia or Borneo, it also dragged a lot of people out of poverty and helped kind of propel the economy and change a place from being a third world nation into somewhere where people like my cousins, you know, could maybe go to school and go to university, whereas my grandmother is illiterate. And and grew up really, really poor in that kind of colonial era. So I felt like this was an opportunity for me to write a fictional story with some insight that other people maybe didn't have. Mm. And you're right. I mean, the novels that I've read that engage with Borneo, there's not all that many from the point of view of Borneans. You know, Joseph Conrad wrote a fair bit about Borneo, but that was like, you know, 150 years ago, and he was from Poland, you know. And there's a lot written, a lot of nonfiction written about logging and palm oil, but I hadn't read any fiction. So I wanted to write the type of story that I would like to read.
And teaser, there is, for the keen reader, a cameo by Joseph Conrad in this novel, Fierce Land. But for the main part, we're with these siblings, Rosanna and Harun. It opens in Borneo in 1998, and their life is really good, right? Like, they've got this fancy apartment with a maid. They're clearly well off. They've got the new Zelda video game to play. And their dad said, come on this trip with me to the Borneo forest. And at first, I think we think, it's going to be this magical adventure in nature. But tell us, what is their dad actually up to? Why are they taking this trip into the forest?
Well, I think in a certain way, the book is about a little bit of a battle for the soul of Rosanna and also Harun between their father, Yusuf Mansur, who's sort of the ultimate capitalist, and this eccentric poet, his best friend, who he grew up with and also studied with in Australia, called Crazy Auntie.
Yeah.
And they kind of have this argument where she is questioning what he is doing in starting these corrupt practices and exploiting the land. And he kind of makes this decision that he wants his children to kind of see the world the way he does and to follow in his footsteps. So he decides to take them into the forest to see what he's up to, because in his mind, this is an example of what a man can do if he sets his mind to something, to achieve greatness and to achieve riches. And so he takes them on this trip up the river. And at first it is very magical, because he also has love for the forest. That's the interesting thing I found reading sort of hagiographies by oil palm tycoons and also scientists who spent time in the jungle doing soil sampling and stuff that was setting the scene in a way for the destruction of the forest, was that a lot of them really loved it. So that kind of confused me a little bit, and it surprised me in my research that there were so many people who were responsible for destroying the rainforest who actually had great affection and admiration for it. And so I kind of built that into the story. And so once they're up the river, they suddenly realize that he's not there to protect the forest. He's there to cut it down and to make a whole lot of money out of it. And there are certain people, local people, who are standing in his way. And so I guess this is, where a lot of the drama comes from in the book, is him sort of, the interaction between Yusuf Mansur and these people who are standing in his way.
Yeah, so something really terrible happens on this trip. And through the novel, we will figure out exactly what that was. But then the novel shifts forward 20 years into the future, to the day where Rosanna and Harun's father dies. Tell me, what is Rosanna's life like 20 years later? Who is she? What is she doing? What is her outlook on the world?
Rosanna is a very rebellious and self-destructive artist trying to make her way in Sydney and drifting through the world, still very much affected by what happened to her as a child, but then also after moving to Australia as a teenager, a bit of sort of out of sight, out of mind, because after what happens in the jungle, she's really raging and tormented, and so the parents send her to Australia. And so she's kind of, dealing with her history, I suppose, but trying to carve out a place for herself fairly unsuccessfully in the world.
Yeah. And not long after she hears the news of her father's death, she goes to the toilet and she throws up, Omar, but she doesn't throw up the way you and I throw up. She throws up feathers. There's a degree of, can I say, magical realism happening in this book?
I suppose so. People have described it as a fever dream or magic realism. I don't really think about it in the same way, because I don't know, our lives are so bizarre anyway and kind of go in and out of nightmares and dreams, and even some of the stuff you see on the news, you don't know whether it's a hallucination or real life. And so I kind of just write what comes to me, and whether, you know, other people want to define it as magic realism, then yes, I suppose so. But I guess I try and write things in a way so that things become so strange and surreal that after a while, it seems normal that a person might start throwing up owl feathers into a toilet in Sydney, and you kind of go, yep, that's just part of the world.
She's taking a lot of ketamine too.
Yeah, she's taking a fair bit of ketamine. That'll do it to you, from what I've heard.
And of course, you know, the other level of magic here is the forest is a kind of character in the book, or a kind of chorus in the book, and it speaks in poetry. Tell me what's going on here.
Well, you mentioned Joseph Conrad before, who was an incredible wordsmith, but fairly problematic in the way that he depicted places like Borneo or Africa in a book like Heart of Darkness. So in some ways, my book is a subversion and a critique of and a response to Heart of Darkness, where the forest or the river or nature or the wilderness becomes a kind of a metaphor for the hearts of man. And also is just a bit of an impressionistic backdrop for the lives of the European characters. Whereas what I wanted to say with this book, and by having the forest be the first speaker in the book, was that the forest and nature is to be respected, and it has an agency and a spirit of its own. It's not just something inert to be acted upon or to be exploited. It has its own spirit. And so I wanted the forest to kind of speak for itself. I wanted, obviously, the local characters to speak for themselves and have names and flesh and blood and flaws, unlike in a book like Heart of Darkness, where they don't, and are just a blur in the background. And then in certain ways, later on, you know, there's a poem called The Song of the Wood, and I even have a kind of artwork that's part of that, where my wife inserted highly sensitive microphones into a 1,000-year-old tree in the jungle and recorded the sound of the sap. And we used the spectral analysis of that sound to create an artwork that appears at a certain point in the book. So it's quite literally the environment speaking to us and speaking back. So I wanted to, I was sort of playing with those ideas with that.
That is extremely cool.
Yeah. It wasn't my idea. It was my wife's idea. So I have to give full credit to Mary or Roberts Musa for that one.
She's a cellist. Is that right?
She's a cellist. Yeah. Yeah. But she also makes kind of quite experimental music where she, goes and takes field recordings and amplifies the quote unquote voices of things like the border wall between Mexico and America or a 1,000-year-old tree in Tawau Hills National Park in Borneo.
It must be amazing in your house, the level of creativity that exists between the two of you.
There's not much financial literacy, but there's a lot of creativity in our household, that's for sure.
There is a beautiful jewel in this story, Fierce Land. It's an Italian bead known as, I think you say, a murina.
Yes.
What is this thing? Tell us what it is.
Well, beads are highly prized in a lot of tribes in Borneo. I guess they're easy to transport. They're very beautiful. And it amazed me when I started researching it that there were beads in the middle of the jungle far up the river that had originally come from Murano and Venice and were hundreds of years old and had been sort of passed hand to hand, over hundreds of years by traders and sailors and pirates and all sorts of people, and eventually ended up in the middle of the jungle where they carried this huge kind of significance and were often these kind of heirloom objects, and sometimes were even traded for slaves and things like that. They were, you know, worth the same as a man's life sometimes amongst some headhunting tribes. And so I actually was on a residency in Italy, and I was walking around some of these glass factories in Murano, and then I just saw a picture of one of these beads, and it said something about how they'd ended up in Borneo as well. So I was kind of on both sides, I was on both sides of that trade route. And I just started thinking about something that's very well trodden in literature, like, you know, the ring in Lord of the Rings. A lot of Borges's work will have stuff where
an object holds this huge kind of almost spiritual or magical significance. And I thought that, you know, a bead might be a really interesting way to sort of show the history of trade and war and cross-pollination in Southeast Asia. And I have had beads appear in a lot of my work, actually. I'm not quite sure what that's about, but maybe I'm sort of under the sway of these magic beads as well.
It allows for this fantastic chapter where you take us back like a couple of centuries and we follow the path of this bead through history until it finds its way to the Borneo forest. And in that scene, we go to 1847. The maker of the jewel tells us that all art is a haunting. Mm. I love that phrase. And I was keen to know, Omar, what that means to you.
It's interesting you picked up on that. That phrase, all art is a haunting. Man, I rewrote that sentence so many times. That's one of those ones. I mean, a lot of my work, I try to let it flow out of me unimpeded and kind of get out of my own way. But then there are certain things where I just go back over it again and again and again, polishing it kind of probably like a jewel or a bead. But I think I was influenced by that idea of hauntology by the French philosopher Jacques Derrida, who talks about that, how we are constantly haunted by the ghosts of language and the ghosts of past ideologies. How, for example, you know, the specter of Marx haunts Europe at all times. And so I was kind of thinking about that throughout the book. How is it that we are all haunted? And when things are destroyed, are they destroyed forever, like the jungle, or, you know, open cut mines at the end of the river, or languages? You know, there's 54 languages in Sabah, where my father comes from, but a lot of them are dying out very rapidly as the Malay language kind of ascends to supremacy and creates this homogeneity of language. And in what ways are we haunted, not just by the actions of our family and people in the past, like the colonizers that appear in the book, but also haunted by forests that have disappeared and languages that have disappeared and cultural practices?
Omar Moussa, the winner of this year's Miles Franklin Literary Award for his novel Fierce Land. It's published by Penguin. Omar has also just published a book of short stories, which you can seek out. It's called The Vape Lord of Queanbeyan. What a great title. And in October, Omar is going to be a guest of the London Literature Festival, curated by the pop star Dua Lipa. So there is a lot to celebrate for Omar Moussa right now. I'm Claire Nichols. Thanks for joining me. We make The Book Show on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.